This is Audible.
Cometh the Hour by Jeffrey Archer. Read by Alex Jennings. Prologue. The PA system crackled. Would all those involved in the Lady Virginia Fenwick versus Mrs. Emma Clifton...
The jury must have reached a decision,
Chufford said, already on the move. He looked round to check that they were all following him, and bumped into someone. He apologized, but the young man didn't look back. Sebastian held open the door to court number 14, so his mother and her silk could resume their places in the front row. Emma was too nervous to speak, and fearing the worst, kept glancing anxiously over her shoulder at Harry, who sat in the row behind her as they waited for the jury to appear. When Mrs. Justice Lane entered the courtroom, everyone stood. She bowed before resuming her place in the high-backed red leather chair on the dais. Emma transferred her attention to the closed door beside the jury box. She didn't have to wait long before it swung open, and the bailiff reappeared, followed by his 12 disciples. They took their time finding their places, treading on each other's toes like late-arriving theatre-goers. The bailiff waited for them to settle before he banged his rod 3 times on the floor and shouted, "Will the foreman please rise?" The foreman rose to his full 5 feet 4 inches and looked up at the judge. Mrs. Justice Lane leant forward and said,
"Have you reached a verdict on which you are all agreed?"
Emma thought her heart would stop beating as she waited for his reply.
"No, my lady." "Then have you reached a verdict on which you are agreed by a majority of at least 10-2?
"We did, my lady," said the foreman, "but unfortunately at the last moment one of our number changed his mind, and we've been stuck on 9-3 for the past hour. I am not convinced that will change, so once again I am seeking your guidance as to what we should do next."
"Do you believe you could reach a majority of 10-2 if I gave you a little more time?"
"I do, my lady, because on one particular matter, all 12 of us are in agreement."
"And what is that?"
"If we were allowed to know the contents of the letter Major Fisher wrote to Mr. Trelford before he committed suicide, we might well be able to come to a decision fairly quickly."
Everybody's eyes were fixed on the judge, except for Lady Virginia's advocate, Sir Edward Makepeace, who was looking closely at Donald Trelford, Emma's defence counsel. Either he was a formidable poker player, or he simply didn't want the jury to know what was in that letter. Trelford rose from his place and reached into his inside pocket, only to find that the letter was no longer there. He looked across to the far side of the court to see that Lady Virginia was smiling. He returned her smile. Harry and Emma Clifton, 1970 to 1971. Chapter 1. The jury was out. The judge had asked the 7 men and 5 women to make one final effort to reach a verdict. Mrs. Justice Lane instructed them to return the following morning. She was beginning to think a hung jury was the most likely outcome. The moment she stood up, everyone in the well of the court rose and bowed. The judge returned the compliment, but it wasn't until she had left the court that a babble of chatter erupted.
"Would you be kind enough to accompany me back to my chambers, Mrs. Clifton?"
said Donald Trelford.
"So we can discuss the contents of Major Fisher's letter and whether they should be made public."
Emma nodded.
"I'd like my husband and brother to join us, if that's possible, as I know Sebastian has to get back to work."
"Of course,"
said Trelford, who gathered up his papers and, without another word, led them out of the courtroom and down the wide marble staircase to the ground floor. As they stepped out onto the Strand, a pack of baying journalists, accompanied by flashing cameras, once again surrounded them, and dogged their steps as they made their way slowly across to the QC's chambers. They were finally left alone once they'd arrived at Lincoln's Inn, an ancient square full of neat-looking townhouses that were in fact chambers occupied by barristers and their clerks. Mr. Trelford led them up a creaky wooden staircase to the top floor of number 11, passing rows of names printed neatly in black on the snow-white walls. When Emma entered Mr. Trelford's office, she was surprised to see how small it was, but then there were no large offices in Lincoln's Inn, even if you were the head of chambers. Once they were all seated, Mr. Trelford looked across at the woman who sat opposite him. Mrs. Clifton appeared calm and composed, even stoical, which was rare for someone who was facing the possibility of defeat and humiliation, unless... He unlocked the top drawer of his desk, extracted a file, and handed copies of Major Fisher's letter to Mr. and Mrs. Clifton and Sir Giles Barrington. The original remained locked in his safe, although he was in no doubt that Lady Virginia had somehow got hold of the copy he had with him in court. Once they had all read the letter, handwritten on House of Commons paper, Trelford said firmly,
"If you will allow me to present this as evidence in open court, Mrs. Clifton, I am confident we can win the case."
"That is out of the question," said Emma, handing her copy back to Trelford.
"I could never allow that,"
she added with the dignity of a woman who knew that the decision might not only destroy her, but also hand victory to her adversary.
"Will you at least allow your husband and Sir Giles to offer their opinion?"
Giles didn't wait for Emma's permission.
"Of course it must be seen by the jury, because once it has, they'll come down unanimously in your favour, and more importantly, Virginia will never be able to show her face in public again."
"Possibly," said Emma calmly. "But at the same time, you would have to withdraw your candidacy for the by-election. And this time the Prime Minister won't be offering you a seat in the House of Lords as compensation. And you can be sure of one thing," she added. "Your ex-wife will consider destroying your political career a far greater prize than defeating me." "No, Mr. Trelford," she continued, not looking at her brother. "This letter will remain a family secret, and we will all have to live with the consequences."
"That's pig-headed of you, sis," said Giles, swinging round. "Perhaps I don't want to spend the rest of my life feeling responsible for you losing the case and having to stand down as chairman of Barrington's. And don't forget you'll also have to pay Virginia's legal costs, not to mention whatever compensation the jury decide to award her."
"It's a price worth paying," said Emma.
"Pig-headed," repeated Giles, a decibel louder, "and I'll bet Harry agrees with me."
They all turned towards Harry, who didn't need to read the letter a second time, as he could have repeated it word for word. However, he was torn between wishing to support his oldest friend and not wanting his wife to lose her libel case. What John Buchan once described as being between a rock and a hard place.
"It's not my decision to make," said Harry. "But if it were my future that was hanging by a thread, I'd want Fisher's letter to be read out in court."
2-1,
said Giles.
"My future isn't hanging by a thread," said Emma. "And you're right, my darling, the final decision is mine."
Without another word, she rose from her place, shook hands with her counsel, and said,
"Thank you, Mr. Trelford. We'll see you in court tomorrow morning, when the jury will decide our fate."
Trelford bowed and waited for the door to close behind them before he murmured to himself,
"She should have been christened Portia." "How did you get hold of this?"
asked Sir Edward. Virginia smiled. Sir Edward had taught her that when facing cross-examination, if an answer doesn't help your cause, you should say nothing. Sir Edward didn't smile.
"If the judge were to allow Mr. Trelford to present this as evidence," he said, waving the letter, "I would no longer be confident that we will win the case. In fact, I'm certain we'd lose." "Mrs. Clifton will never allow it to be presented as evidence,"
said Virginia confidently.
"How can you be sure?"
Her brother intends to fight the by-election in Bristol Docklands caused by Major Fisher's death. If this letter were to be made public, he'd have to withdraw. It would end his political career.
Lawyers are meant to have opinions on everything except their clients. Not in this case. Sir Edward knew exactly how he felt about Lady Virginia, and it didn't bear repeating, in or out of court.
"If you're right, Lady Virginia," said the elderly QC, "and they don't offer the letter as evidence, the jury will assume it's because it doesn't assist Mrs. Clifton's cause. That would undoubtedly tip the balance in your favor."
Virginia tore up the letter and dropped the little pieces into the waste paper basket.
"I agree with you, Sir Edward."
Once again, Desmond Mellor had booked a small conference room in an unfashionable hotel where no one would recognize them.
"Lady Virginia is the odds-on favorite to win a two-horse race," said Mellor from his place at the head of the table. "It seems Alex Fisher ended up doing something worthwhile for a change."
"Fisher's timing couldn't have been better," said Adrian Sloane. "But we'll still need to have everything in place if there's to be a smooth takeover of Barrington Shipping."
"Couldn't agree with you more," said Mellor, "which is why I've already drafted a press statement that I want you to release as soon as the verdict has been announced."
"But all that could change if Mrs. Clifton allows Fisher's letter to be read out in court."
"I can assure you," said Mellor, "that letter will never see the light of day." "You know what's in that letter, don't you?" said Jim Knowles. "Let's just say I'm confident that Mrs. Clifton will not want the jury to see it, which will only convince them that our beloved chairman has something to hide. Then they will surely come down in Lady Virginia's favor, and that will be an end of the matter. As they're likely to reach a verdict sometime tomorrow," said Knowles, "I've called an emergency board meeting for Monday morning at 10 o'clock. There will only be two items on the agenda. The first will be to accept Mrs. Clifton's resignation, followed by the appointment of Desmond as chairman of the new company. And my first decision as chairman will be to appoint Jim as my deputy."
Sloane frowned.
"Then I'll ask Adrian to join the board, which will leave the city and the shareholders in no doubt that Barrington's is under new management."
"Once the other board members have read this," said Knowles, waving the press statement as if it were an order paper, "it shouldn't be long before the Admiral and his cronies decide they have no choice but to hand in their resignations."
"Which I will reluctantly accept," said Mellor, before adding, "with a heavy heart."
"I'm not convinced Sebastian Clifton will fall in with our plans quite that easily," said Sloane. "If he decides to remain on the board, it might not be quite the smooth transition you have in mind, Desmond."
"I can't imagine Clifton will want to be a director of the Mellor Shipping Company after his mother has been publicly humiliated by Lady Virginia, not only in court, but in every national newspaper."
"You must know what's in that letter," repeated Knowles. Giles made no attempt to change his sister's mind, because he realized it would be pointless. Among Emma's many qualities was a fierce loyalty to her family, her friends, and any cause she believed in. But the other side of that coin was a stubbornness that sometimes allowed her personal feelings to override her common sense, even if her decision could result in losing the libel case and even having to resign as chairman of Barrington's. Giles knew, because he could be just as obstinate. It must be a family trait, he decided. Harry, on the other hand, was far more pragmatic. He would have weighed up the options and considered the alternatives long before he came to a decision. However, Giles suspected Harry was torn between supporting his wife and loyalty to his oldest friend. As the three of them stepped back out onto Lincoln's Inn Fields, The first gaslights were being lit by the lamplighter.
"I'll see you both back at the house for dinner," said Giles. "I've got a couple of errands to run. And by the way, sis, thank you."
Harry hailed the taxi, and he and his wife climbed into the back. Giles didn't move until the cab had turned the corner and was out of sight. He then headed off at a brisk pace in the direction of Fleet Street. Chapter 2 Sebastian rose early the following morning, and after reading the Financial Times and the Daily Telegraph, he just couldn't see how his mother could hope to win her libel trial. The Telegraph pointed out to its readers that if the contents of Major Fisher's letter remained a secret, it wouldn't help Mrs. Clifton's cause. The FT concentrated on the problems Barrington Shipping would face should its chairman lose the case and have to resign. The company's shares had already fallen by a shilling, as many of its shareholders had clearly decided that Lady Virginia was going to be the victor. Seb felt the best his mother could hope for was a hung jury. Like everyone else, he couldn't stop wondering what was in the letter Mr. Trelford wouldn't allow him to read, and which side it was more likely to help. When he had phoned his mother after returning from work, she hadn't been forthcoming on the subject. He didn't bother to ask his father. Sebastian turned up at the bank even earlier than usual, but once he'd sat down at his desk and begun trying to work his way through the morning mail, he found he couldn't concentrate. After his secretary, Rachel, had asked him several questions which remained unanswered, she gave up and suggested he go to court and not return until the jury had delivered its verdict. He reluctantly agreed. As his taxi drove out of the city and into Fleet Street, Seb spotted the bold headline on a Daily Mail placard and shouted, "Stop!" The cabbie swung into the curb and threw on his brakes. Seb jumped out and ran across to the paper boy. He handed him fourpence and grabbed a copy of the paper. As he stood on the pavement reading the front page, he felt conflicting emotions. Delight for his mother, who would now surely win her case and be vindicated, and sadness for his Uncle Giles, who had clearly sacrificed his political career to do what he considered the honourable thing, because Seb knew his mother would never have allowed that letter to be seen by anyone outside the family. He climbed back into the cab and wondered, as he stared out of the window, how he would have reacted had he been faced with the same dilemma. Was the pre-war generation guided by a different moral compass? He wasn't in any doubt what his father would have done, or how angry his mother would be with Giles. His thoughts turned to Samantha, who had returned to America when he'd let her down. What would she have done in similar circumstances? If only she would give him a second chance, he wouldn't make the same mistake again. Seb checked his watch. Most God-fearing people in Washington would still be asleep, so he realized he couldn't phone his daughter Jessica's headmistress, Dr. Wolfe, to find out why she wanted to speak to him urgently. Was it just possible? The taxi pulled up outside the Royal Courts of Justice in the Strand.
"That'll be 4 and 6, Governor," said the cabbie, interrupting his thoughts.
Seb handed him 2 half-crowns. As he stepped out of the cab, the cameras immediately began to flash. The first words he could make out above the melee of hollering hacks was,
"Have you read Major Fisher's letter?"
When Mrs. Justice Lane entered Court 14 and took her place in the high-backed chair on the raised dais, she didn't look pleased. The judge wasn't in any doubt that although she had firmly instructed the jury not to read any newspapers while the trial was taking place, the only subject they will be discussing in the jury room that morning would be the front page of the Daily Mail. She had no idea who was responsible for leaking Major Fisher's letter, but that didn't stop her, like everyone else in that courtroom, from having an opinion. Although the letter had been sent to Mr. Trelford, she was certain it couldn't have been him. He would never involve himself in such underhand tactics. She knew some barristers who would have turned a blind eye, even condoned such behaviour, but not Donald Trelford. He would rather lose a case than swim in such murky waters. She was equally confident that it couldn't have been Lady Virginia Fenwick, because it would only have harmed her cause. Had leaking the letter assisted her, she would have been the judge's first suspect. Mrs. Justice Lane looked down at Mrs. Clifton, whose head was bowed. During the past week, she'd come to admire the defendant, and felt she would like to get to know her better once the trial was over. But that would not be possible. In fact, she would never speak to the woman again. If she were to do so, it would unquestionably be grounds for a retrial. If the judge had to guess who had been responsible for leaking the letter, she would have placed a small wager on Sir Giles Barrington. But she never guessed and never gambled. She only considered the evidence. However, the fact that Sir Giles was not in court that morning might have been considered as evidence, even if it was circumstantial. The judge turned her attention to Sir Edward Makepeace, who never gave anything away. The eminent Silk had conducted his brief quite brilliantly, and his eloquent advocacy had undoubtedly assisted Lady Virginia's case. But that was before Mr. Trelford had brought Major Fisher's letter to the court's attention. The judge understood why neither Emma Clifton nor Lady Virginia would want the letter to be disclosed in open court, although she was sure Mr. Trelford would have pressed his client to allow him to enter it in evidence. After all, he represented Mrs. Clifton, not her brother. Mrs. Justice Lane assumed it wouldn't be long before the jury returned and delivered their verdict. When Giles phoned his constituency headquarters in Bristol that morning, he and his agent, Griff Haskins, didn't need to hold a long conversation. Having read the front page of the Mail, Griff reluctantly accepted that Giles would have to withdraw his name as the Labour candidate for the forthcoming by-election in Bristol Docklands.
"It's typical Fisher," said Giles, "full of half-truths, exaggeration and innuendo."
"That doesn't surprise me," said Griff.
"But can you prove it before polling day? Because one thing's for certain, the Tories' eve of poll message will be Fisher's letter, and they'll push it through every letterbox in the constituency."
"We'd do the same, given half a chance," admitted Giles.
"But if you could prove it was a pack of lies," said Griff, refusing to give up.
"I don't have time to do that, and even if I did, I'm not sure anyone would believe me. Dead men's words are so much more powerful than those of the living."
"Then there's only one thing left for us to do," said Griff. "Let's go on a bender and drown our sorrows."
"I did that last night," admitted Giles. "God knows what else."
"Once we've chosen a new candidate," said Griff, quickly slipping back into election mode, "I'd like you to brief him or her, because whoever we pick will need your support and, more important, your experience."
"That might not turn out to be an advantage in the circumstances," Giles suggested.
"Stop being so pathetic," said Griff.
"I've got a feeling we won't get rid of you quite that easily. The Labour Party is in your blood. And wasn't it Harold Wilson who said a week is a long time in politics?"
When the inconspicuous door swung open, everyone in the courtroom stopped talking and turned to watch as the bailiff stood aside to allow the 7 men and 5 women to enter the court and take their places in the jury box. The judge waited for them to settle before she leant forward and asked the foreman,
"Have you been able to reach a verdict?"
The foreman rose slowly from his place, adjusted his spectacles, looked up at the judge and said,
"Yes, we have, my lady."
"And is your decision unanimous?"
"It is, my lady."
"Have you found in favour of the plaintiff, Lady Virginia Fenwick, or the defendant, Mrs. Emma Clifton?"
"We have found in favour of the defendant," said the foreman, who, having completed his task, sat back down.
Sebastian leapt to his feet and was about to cheer when he noticed that both his mother and the judge were scowling at him. He quickly resumed his seat, and looked across at his father, who winked at him. On the other side of the court sat a woman who was glaring at the jury, unable to hide her displeasure, while her counsel sat impassively with his arms folded. Once Sir Edward had read the front page of the Daily Mail that morning, he'd realized that his client had no chance of winning the case. He could have demanded a retrial, but in truth Sir Edward wouldn't have advised his client to put herself through a second trial with the odds tipped so heavily against her. Giles sat alone at the breakfast table at his home in Smith Square, his usual routine abandoned. No bowl of cornflakes, no orange juice, no boiled egg, no Times, no Guardian, just a copy of the Daily Mail laid out on the table in front of him. House of Commons, London, SW1A, 0AA, 12th of November, 1970. Dear Mr. Trelford, you will be curious to know why I have chosen to write to you and not Sir Edward Makepeace. The answer is, quite simply, I have no doubt that both of you will act in the best interests of your clients. Allow me to begin with Sir Edward's client, Lady Virginia Fenwick, and her fatuous claim that I was nothing more than her professional adviser, who always worked at arm's length. Nothing could be further from the truth. I have never known a client who was more hands-on, and when it came to the buying and selling of Barrington shares, she only had one purpose in mind, namely to destroy the company, whatever the cost, along with the reputation of its chairman, Mrs. Clifton. A few days before the trial was due to open, Lady Virginia offered me a substantial sum of money to claim that she had given me carte blanche to act on her behalf, in order to leave the jury with the impression that she didn't really understand how the stock market worked. Let me assure you that in reply to Lady Virginia's question to Mrs. Clifton at the AGM, "Is it true that one of your directors sold his vast shareholding in an attempt to bring the company down?" the fact is that is exactly what Lady Virginia herself did on no fewer than three occasions, and she nearly succeeded in bringing Barrington's down. I cannot go to my grave with that injustice on my conscience. However, there is another injustice that is equally unpalatable, and that I am also unable to ignore. My death will cause a by-election in the constituency of Bristol Docklands, and I know that the Labour Party will consider re-selecting the former Member of Parliament, Sir Giles Barrington, as its candidate. But like Lady Virginia, Sir Giles is hiding a secret he does not wish to share, even with his own family. When Sir Giles recently visited East Berlin as a representative of Her Majesty's government, he had what he later described in a press statement as a one-night stand with a Miss Karin Pengelly, his official interpreter. Later he gave this as the reason his wife had left him. Although this was Sir Giles's second divorce on the grounds of adultery, I do not consider that that alone should be sufficient reason for a man to withdraw from public life. But in this case, his callous treatment of the lady in question makes it impossible for me to remain silent. Having spoken to Miss Pengelly's father, I know for a fact that his daughter has written to Sir Giles on several occasions to let him know that not only did she lose her job as a result of their liaison, but she is now pregnant with his child. Despite this, Sir Giles has not even paid Miss Pengelly the courtesy of replying to her letters or showing the slightest concern for her predicament. She does not complain. However, I do so on her behalf, and I am bound to ask, is this the kind of person who should be representing his constituents in the House of Commons? No doubt the citizens of Bristol will express their opinion at the ballot box. I apologize, sir, for placing the burden of responsibility on your shoulders, but I felt I had been left with no choice. Yours sincerely, Alexander Fisher, Major, retired. Giles stared down at his political obituary. Chapter 3. "Welcome back, Chairman," said Jim Knowles as Emma walked into the boardroom.
Not that I doubted for a moment that you would return in triumph.
Hear, hear, said Clive Anscott, pulling back Emma's chair so she could take her place at the head of the table.
Thank you, said Emma as she sat down.
She looked around the boardroom table and smiled at her fellow directors. They all returned her smile.
Item number one.
Emma looked down at the agenda, as if nothing untoward had taken place during the past month.
As Mr. Knowles convened this meeting at short notice, the company's secretary hasn't had time to distribute the minutes of the last board meeting, so I'll ask him to read them to us now.
Will that be necessary, given the circumstances? Asked Knowles.
I'm not sure I am fully aware of the circumstances, Mr. Knowles, said Emma, but I suspect we're about to find out.
Philip Webster, the company's secretary, rose from his place, gave a nervous cough. Some things never change, thought Emma, and began to read out the minutes as if he were announcing what train was due to arrive on Platform 4. A board meeting was held at Barrington House on Tuesday the 10th of November 1970. All the directors were present with the exception of Mrs. Emma Clifton and Mr. Sebastian Clifton, who both sent their apologies, explaining that they were otherwise engaged. Following the resignation of the deputy chairman, Mr. Desmond Mellor, and in the absence of Mrs. Clifton, it was agreed by common consent that Mr. Jim Knowles should take the chair. There then followed a long discussion on the future of the company and what action should be taken if Lady Virginia Fenwick were to win her libel case against Mrs. Clifton. Admiral Summers placed on record that he considered nothing should be done until the outcome of the trial was known, as he was confident that the chairman would be vindicated. Emma smiled at the old sea dog. If the ship had sunk, he would have been the last to leave the bridge. Mr. Knowles, however, did not share the Admiral's confidence, and informed the board that he had been following the case closely and had come to the reluctant conclusion that Mrs. Clifton didn't have a snowball's chance in hell, and that not only would Lady Virginia win, but the jury would award her substantial damages. Mr. Knowles then reminded the board that Mrs. Clifton had made it clear she would resign as chairman if that was the outcome. He went on to say that he considered it was nothing more than the board's duty to consider the company's future in that eventuality, and in particular, who should replace Mrs. Clifton as chairman. Mr. Clive Anscott agreed with the acting chairman and proposed the name of Mr. Desmond Mellor, who had recently written to him explaining why he felt he had to resign from the board. In particular, he had stated that he could not consider remaining on the board while that woman was in charge. There then followed a long discussion in the course of which it became clear that the directors were evenly divided on the issue of how to handle the problem. Mr. Knowles, in his summing up, concluded that two statements should be prepared, and once the result of the trial was known, the appropriate one should be released to the press. Admiral Summers stated that there will be no need for a press statement, because once Mrs. Clifton had been exonerated, it would be business as usual. Mr. Knowles pressed Admiral Summers on what he would do if Lady Virginia won the case. The Admiral replied that he would resign as a member of the board, as there were no circumstances in which he would be willing to serve under Mr. Mellor. Mr. Knowles asked for the Admiral's words to be recorded in the minutes. He then went on to outline his strategy for the company's future, should the worst happen.
And what was your strategy, Mr. Knowles?
Asked Emma innocently. Mr. Webster turned to the next page of the minutes.
It's no longer relevant, said Knowles, giving the chairman a warm smile. After all, the Admiral has been proved right. But I did consider it no more than my duty to prepare the board for every eventuality.
The only eventuality you should have prepared for, snorted Admiral Summers, was handing in your resignation before this meeting took place.
Don't you think that's a little rough? Chipped in Andy Dobbs. After all, Jim was placed in an unenviable position.
Loyalty is never unenviable, said the Admiral. Unless, of course, you're a cad.
Sebastian suppressed a smile. He couldn't believe anyone still used the word cad in the second half of the 20th century. He personally felt fucking hypocrite would have been more appropriate, although in truth it wouldn't have been any more effective.
"Perhaps the company secretary should read out Mr. Knowles's statement," said Emma, "the one that would have been released to the press had I lost the case."
Mr. Webster extracted a single sheet of paper from his file, but before he had the chance to utter a word, Knowles rose from his place, gathered up his papers, and said,
"That won't be necessary, Chairman, because I tender my resignation."
Without another word, he turned to leave, but not before Admiral Summers muttered,
"Not a moment too soon."
He then fixed his gimlet eye on the two other directors who had backed Knowles. After a moment's hesitation, Clive Anscott and Andy Dobbs also stood up and quietly left the room. Emma waited for the door to close before she spoke again.
"From time to time, I may have appeared impatient with the company secretary's fastidious recording of the board's minutes. I now concede that Mr. Webster has proved me wrong, and I apologize unreservedly."
"Do you wish me to record your sentiments in the minutes, Madam Chairman?"
asked Webster, without a hint of irony. This time, Sebastian did allow himself a smile. Chapter 4. Once Harry had edited the fourth draft of Anatoly Babakov's remarkable memoirs of Stalin's Russia, all he wanted to do was take the first available flight to New York and hand the manuscript of Uncle Joe to his publisher, Harold Ginsberg. But there was something even more important that prevented him from leaving, an event he had no intention of missing under any circumstances: his mother's 70th birthday party. Maisie had lived in a cottage on the Manor House estate since her second husband's death 3 years before. She remained actively involved with several local charities, and although she rarely missed her daily 3-mile constitutional, it was now taking her over an hour. Harry would never forget the personal sacrifices his mother had made to ensure he won a choral scholarship to St. Bede's, and with it the chance to compete with anyone, whatever their background, including his oldest friend, Giles Barrington. Harry and Giles had first met at St. Bede's over 40 years ago, and seemed an unlikely pair to end up as best friends, one born in the back streets of the docks, the other in a private ward of the Bristol Royal Infirmary, one a scholar, the other a sportsman, one shy, the other extrovert. And certainly no one would have predicted that Harry would fall in love with Giles's sister, except Emma herself, who claimed she had planned the whole thing after they'd first met at Giles's 12th birthday party. All Harry could remember of that occasion was a skinny little object, Giles's description, sitting by the window, head down, reading a book. He had remembered the book, but not the girl. Harry met a very different young woman 7 years later, when the grammar school joined Red Maids for a combined school production of Romeo and Juliet. It was Elizabeth Barrington, Emma's mother, who noticed that they continued to hold hands after they'd left the stage. When the curtain came down on the final performance, Harry admitted to his mother that he'd fallen in love with Emma and wanted to marry her. It had come as a shock that Maisie didn't seem delighted by the prospect. Emma's father, Sir Hugo Barrington, made no attempt to hide his feelings, although his wife couldn't explain why he was so vehemently opposed to any suggestion of them marrying. Surely he couldn't be that much of a snob. But despite both their parents' misgivings, Harry and Emma became engaged just before they went up to Oxford. Both virgins, they didn't sleep together until a few weeks before the wedding. But the wedding ended in tears, because when the college chaplain said, "If any man can show any just cause why they may not lawfully be joined together, let him now speak, or else hereafter forever hold his peace," old Jack, Harry's mentor and friend, hadn't held his peace, and told the congregation why he feared he had just cause. When Harry learned the truth about who his father might be, he was so distraught he immediately left Oxford and joined the Merchant Navy, unaware that Emma was pregnant, or that while he was crossing the Atlantic, England had declared war on Germany. It wasn't until he'd been released from prison, joined the U.S. Army, and been blown up by a German landmine, that he finally returned to England to be reunited with Emma, only to discover that he had a 3-year-old son called Sebastian. Even then, it was still another 2 years before the highest court in the land decided that Sir Hugo Barrington was not Harry's father, but despite the ruling, both he and Emma were aware that there would always be a lingering doubt about the legitimacy of their marriage in an even higher court. Harry and Emma had desperately wanted to have a second child, but they agreed not to tell Sebastian why they had decided against it. Harry never, even for a moment, placed any blame on his beloved mother. It hadn't taken a lot of digging to discover that Maisie had not been the first factory worker to be seduced by Hugo Barrington on the annual works outing to Weston-super-Mare. When Sir Hugo died in tragic circumstances, Giles inherited his title along with the estates, and the natural order of things was finally restored. However, while Harry had remained happily married to Emma, Giles had been through 2 divorces, and his political career now seemed to be in tatters. Emma had spent the past 3 months preparing for the big event, and nothing had been left to chance. Harry was even made to deliver a dress rehearsal of his speech in their bedroom the night before. 300 guests beat a path to the manor house for a black-tie dinner to celebrate Maisie's 7 decades, and when she made her entrance on Harry's arm, it wasn't difficult for anyone to believe that she must have been one of the great beauties of her day. Harry sat down beside her and beamed with pride, although he became more and more nervous as the moment approached when he would have to propose his mother's health. Performing in front of a packed audience no longer troubled him, but in front of his mother. He began by reminding the guests of his mother's formidable achievements against all the odds. She had progressed from being a waitress in Tilly's Tea Room to manager of the city's Grand Hotel, the first woman to hold that position. After she had reluctantly retired at the age of 60, Maisie had enrolled as a mature student at Bristol University, where she read English and 3 years later graduated with honours, something Harry, Emma and Sebastian hadn't achieved, all for different reasons. When Maisie rose to reply, the whole room rose with her. She opened her speech like a seasoned pro, not a note, not a tremor.
"Mothers always believe their sons are special," she began, "and I'm no exception. Of course I'm proud of Harry's many achievements, not only as a writer, but, more importantly, as president of English Pen, and as a campaigner on behalf of his less fortunate colleagues in other countries. In my opinion, his campaign to have Anatoly Babakov released from a Siberian gulag is a far greater achievement than topping the New York Times bestseller list. But the cleverest thing Harry has ever done was to marry Emma. Behind every great man..."
Laughter and applause suggested that the audience agreed with Maisie.
"Emma is a remarkable woman in her own right. The first female chairman of a public company, yet she still somehow manages to be an exemplary wife and mother. And then, of course, there's my grandson, Sebastian, who I'm told will be the next governor of the Bank of England. That must be right, because it was Sebastian himself who told me."
"I'd rather be chairman of Farthing's Bank,"
Seb whispered to his Aunt Grace, who was seated beside him.
"All in good time, dear boy."
Maisie ended with the words,
"This has been the happiest day of my life, and I count myself lucky to have so many friends."
Harry waited for the applause to subside before he rose again to propose Maisie's long life and happiness. The assembled guests raised their glasses and continued to cheer as if it was the last night of the proms.
"I'm sorry to see you on your own again, Seb,"
said Grace once the applause had died down and everyone had resumed their seats. Seb didn't respond. Grace took her nephew's hand.
Hasn't the time finally come for you to accept that Samantha is married and has another life? I wish it was that easy, said Seb. I regret not marrying and having children, Grace confided. And that's something I've not even told my sister. But I do know that Emma wants so much to be a grandmother. She already is, whispered Seb. And like you, that's something I've never told her.
Grace's mouth opened, but no words came out.
Sam has a little girl called Jessica, Seb said. I only needed to see her once to know she was my daughter. Now I begin to understand, said Grace. Is there really no chance you and Samantha can be reconciled? Not while her husband is still alive. I'm so sorry, said Grace, squeezing her nephew's hand.
Harry was delighted to see his brother-in-law chatting amiably to Griff Haskins, the Labour Party agent for Bristol Docklands. Perhaps the wily old pro could still persuade Giles to allow his name to go forward, despite Major Fisher's poisonous intervention. After all, Giles had been able to show that the letter was peppered with half-truths and was clearly an attempt to settle old scores.
So, have you finally made a decision about the by-election?
Asked Harry, when Giles broke away from Griff to join him.
I've not been left with a lot of choice, said Giles. Two divorces and a dalliance with an East German woman, who may even be a Stasi spy, doesn't make one the ideal candidate. But the press seem convinced that whoever the Labour candidate is, they're certain to win by a landslide while this Tory government remains so unpopular. It's not the press or even the electorate who will select the candidate, but a group of men and women who make up the local selection committee. And I can tell you, Harry, there's nothing more conservative than a Labour Party selection committee. I'm still convinced they back you now they know the truth. Why don't you throw your hat in the ring and let them decide? Because if they ask me how I feel about Karen, they might not like the answer.
It was kind of you to include me in such an illustrious occasion, Mrs. Clifton.
Don't be silly, Hakim. Your name was one of the first on the guest list. No one could have done more for Sebastian. And after that rather unpleasant experience with Adrian Sloane, I should be forever in your debt, which I know your countrymen don't take lightly.
You have to know who your friends are when you spend so much time looking over your shoulder, Mrs. Clifton.
Emma, she insisted. And tell me, Hakim, what exactly do you see when you look over your shoulder?
An unholy trinity that I suspect has plans to rise from the dead and once again try to take control of Farthing's, and possibly even Barrington's.
But Mellor and Knowles are no longer on the board of Barrington's. And Sloane has forfeited whatever reputation he had in the city.
True. But that hasn't stopped them forming a new company.
Mellor Travel.
Which I don't imagine will be recommending that their customers book a holiday on the Barrington line.
We'll survive, said Emma.
And I presume you know that Lady Virginia Fenwick is considering selling her shares in Barrington's. My spies tell me she's a bit strapped for cash at the moment.
Is she indeed? Well, I wouldn't want those shares to fall into the wrong hands.
You needn't worry about that, Emma. I've already instructed Sebastian to pick them up the moment they come on the market. Be assured that if anyone even thinks about attacking you again, Hakim Bishara and his caravan of camels will be at your disposal.
It's Deacon's, isn't it?
Said Maisie, as a thin, middle-aged man with prematurely grey hair came up to her to pay his respects. He was dressed in the suit he must have graduated in.
I'm flattered that you remember me, Mrs. Clifton. How could I ever forget? After all, Harry never stopped reminding me. Deakins is in my class, but frankly, he's in a different class.
And I was proved right, Mother, said Harry, as he joined them, because Deakins is now Regius Professor of Greek at Oxford, and, like myself, he mysteriously disappeared during the war, but while I ended up in jail, he was at a place called Bletchley Park. Not that he ever reveals what went on behind those moss-covered walls.
And I doubt he ever will,
said Maisie, looking more closely at Deakins.
Did you ever see the picture of we three?
Said Giles, appearing by Deakins' side.
Which play?
Demanded Harry.
Twelfth Night,
said Giles.
Not bad, but which character says the words and to whom?
The fool to Sir Andrew Aguecheek.
And who else?
Sir Toby Belch.
Impressive, said Deakins, smiling at his old friend. But for an alpha, which act and which scene?
Giles fell silent.
Act two, scene three, said Harry. But did you spot the one-word mistake? Did you never see?
Said Maisie. This silenced the three of them, until Emma came across and said,
Stop showing off and circulate. This isn't an old boys' reunion.
She always was a bossy little thing, said Giles, as the old school chums split up and began to mingle with the other guests.
When a woman shows some leadership, said Maisie, she's immediately branded as bossy. But when a man does exactly the same thing, he's described as decisive and a born leader.
"'Twas ever thus," said Emma.
"'Perhaps we should do something about it." "'You already have, my dear."
After the last guest had departed, Harry and Emma accompanied Maisie back to her cottage.
"'Thank you for the second happiest day of my life,"
said Maisie.
"'In your speech, Mother,"
Harry reminded her,
"'You said it was the happiest day of your life."
"'No, not even close,"
replied Maisie.
"'That will always be reserved for the day I discovered you were still alive."
Chapter 5 Harry always enjoyed visiting his New York publisher, but he wondered if anything would have changed now that Aaron Ginsberg had taken over from his father as chairman. He took the lift to the seventh floor, and when the door slid open, he found Kirsty, Harold's long-suffering former secretary, waiting for him. At least that hadn't changed. Kirsty led him briskly down the corridor to the chairman's office. A gentle tap on the door before she opened it, to allow Harry to enter another world. Aaron, like his father before him, considered it must have been a clerical error by the Almighty that he had not been born on the other side of the Atlantic. He wore a double-breasted, pinstriped suit, probably tailored in Savile Row, a white shirt with a starched collar, and a Yale tie. Harry could have been forgiven for thinking Aaron's father had been cloned. The publisher jumped up from behind his desk to greet his favourite author. Over the years, the two of them had become close friends, and once Harry had sat down in the ancient leather armchair on the other side of the publisher's large desk, he spent a few moments taking in the familiar surroundings. The oak-panelled walls were still covered in sepia photographs. Hemingway, Faulkner, Buchan, Fitzgerald, Green, and, more recently, Sorbello. Harry couldn't help wondering if he would ever join them. He'd already outsold most of the authors on the wall, but the Ginsbergs didn't measure success by sales alone.
"'Congratulations, Harry.'
The same warm, sincere voice.
Number one again. William Warwick becomes more popular with every book, and having read Babakov's revelations that Khrushchev had a hand in killing Stalin, I can't wait to publish Uncle Joe. I'm confident that book is also heading for the top spot, albeit on the nonfiction list. It's a truly amazing work, replied Harry. I only wish I'd written it.
"'I suspect you did write a great deal of it,' said Aaron, "'because I detect your hand on almost every page.'
He looked questioningly at Harry. Every word is Anatoly's. I am nothing more than his faithful scribe.
If that's the way you want to play it, that's fine by me. However, your most ardent fans just might notice your style and phraseology creeping in from time to time.
Then we'll both have to stick to the same hymn sheet, won't we?
If you say so.
I do, said Harry firmly.
Aaron nodded.
I've drawn up a contract for Uncle Joe which will require Mrs. Babakova's signature as her husband's representative. I'm willing to offer her a $100,000 advance on signing against a 10% royalty.
How many copies do you think you'll sell?
1 million, possibly more.
Then I want the royalty to rise to 12.5% after the first 100,000 sales, and 15% once you've sold 250,000.
I've never given such good terms for a first book, protested Aaron.
This isn't a first book, it's a last book, a one-off, a one-and-only book.
I accept your terms, said Aaron.